most important.
Some of you will have to fill the
evaluation form. Can you please do it? Can you please bring it in today? Because yesterday there were a whole slew of emails exchanging visor forms. Didn't appear. So please, guys, return the form today. Okay, so let me just mention a very few words about instant bonds that I need today. So one thing is that I tried to discuss last time that SU2 as a group is isomorphic to S3, right? And so then when we talk about Euclidean actions, so Euclidean actions of SU2 gauge group. So we can get an interesting finite finite action solutions corresponding to instant bonds, and they are corresponding to the mapping of the S3 of the gauge group, right, into the S3, which is the 3-sphere at the boundary, right, as absolute value of x goes to 0. And so the only thing I want to clarify, actually I said this last time, just to make sure. So we start with the Lie algebra, right? And for the SU2 Lie algebra, the generators are just fully matrices. So I can construct an arbitrary element of the SU2 by simply saying that I'm exponentiating with angle the generator of the SU2 Lie algebra. So I can write down an arbitrary element of this type. And so so I can think of this. So G is 2x2 matrix, and determinant of this matrix. So the determinant of this matrix must be equal to 1. And so what I just told you that arbitrary 2x2 element of the SU2, I can write down as an exponential of the generators of the corresponding algebra. But then if I expand this and I use a dynamic between fully matrices, then I will get something like U naught plus U sub A times tau A, where U sub A are just pretty much the Euler angles on the 3-sphere. And there will be one constraint, so which is U zero squared plus absolute value U A squared equal to 1, which simply comes from the conditions of determinant of G must be equal to 1. So what I did, I provided you, and this defines NS. Right? So I showed you that there is an isomorphism between SU2 as a group and the S3, and so the instantons are just the non-trivial maps from the gauge group into a space-time, and we constructed some of the instanton solutions there. So one thing that I didn't have time to discuss, but I will need it today, theta terms. So remember that we talked in gauge series about additional term which involves in the action, which was of this type. So it's an integral from d4x. Theta over 16 pi squared. And so, for example, I have a trace in the fundamental representation of FF dual, right? So again, for our purposes, we just talked about SU2 gauge theory. And so the interesting aspect of this term, and one of the reasons why the theta angle, you haven't heard about this, is that this term is actually a total derivative. Well, let me mark it that F tilde mu nu is just 1/2 epsilon mu nu rho lambda F rho lambda. And so it turns out that the combination there, you can write down as a total derivative. So this takes form theta over h pi squared and integral over e4x epsilon mu nu or sigma del mu. So here I have a trace, it's a fundamental representation So W acts, acts on all that trace. So here I have a nu, a rho of a sigma, and then I have two-thirds a nu, a rho, a sigma. Okay, so this is a total derivative, right? So this term is a total derivative. And so what this means, that it will not contribute, to any equation of motion. Now, what we discussed, yesterday in somewhat very crumpled form is that if we go, this is precisely the term, that if we were to take this space, Euclidean, then and we look at the self-dual or anti-self-dual configurations, then this is precisely the instanton action, right? So and in particular, this term is normalized in exactly this way, so that this is in Euclidean. So that in Euclidean space, it becomes just well, what's appropriate minus sign, minimalization times. We call it times n, where n was this instanton winding number. It's the topological property of the map that I was mentioning before. Okay, however, I can construct a similar winding solutions even in a non-compact space. Okay, I need to go into non-compact space because I want to study the effects of these winding configurations. When I use Minkowski space time, and what I want to do actually now is to explain why theta is called a theta angle. Why is it an angle? Right. So you can say, okay, fine. So it's a parameter. And when we talk about Euclidean solution and we evaluate it on a self-dual solution, it's actually an integer. But those are Euclidean solutions, right? So I'm going to explain you why this is actually an angle and we need this. Well, the point is that we can construct, so in the Minkowski space, I have R3, comma 1, right? So that's my Minkowski space, right? And so if I go, so the space is R3, and so the only difference. So if I look at R3 and I look at S3, so locally they are the same. And so the only difference is, one, this is compact, this is not compact. However, I can construct a winding solutions, a solutions that even in Minkowski space time will produce me a non-vanishing integral of that type. If I identify points on S3, so what we're going to do, we're going to identify infinities on R3. And so if we do that, it turns out that in that case, it's possible to construct, to extend this Euclidean analysis. And now we can talk about, that even in the Minkowski space time, this integral is quantized with precisely this normalization, right? So trace from the fundamental f of dual, so it's equal to theta times some integer. Now, once we talk about, once we are in a Minkowski spacetime, then my coefficient function is a function of the integral, right, over h potential. And then I have e to the is, right? And so you can see that even though these theta terms, they do not contribute to the equation of motion. So so that combination n, so this s I can write down as s Young Beals plus s topological, right? So this is a topological term. Let's say this is a topological term. This depends on the boundary condition. But much like we constructed instanton solutions in the Euclidean space, we can do exactly the same in Minkowski space if we identify infinities on R3. And notice that the effect of this topological term. So I still have my Young-Mills action, and then the topological term is quantized. So I have plus I theta n. And so strictly speaking, what I have to do, I have to try and write in the full path integral, I have to sum over all possible instanton sectors, right? So well, in this case, it's not exactly the instant, but exactly the sectors of this large gauge transformation. So from this picture, it's clear why theta is an angle, because theta goes to theta plus 2 pi is exactly the symmetry. It's a classical symmetry. Classical symmetry. Okay, of the series. And I emphasize that it's classical. Why it's classical, I'll mention it in a second. So you can see that shifting theta by 2 pi is precisely a 2 pi n shift, where n, just a bit of the dimension here, that n is an integer. So we have, that's the reason why theta is an angle. Now, another thing, just to connect everything together, another thing, remember that we talked about anomalies that was before we talked about instantons yesterday, anomalies. And so what we studied with you, we discussed that the vector currents are conserved, but axial currents do not conserve all the time. And so if classically we have a conservation law for an axial current of this type. So quantum mechanically what happens is that zero gets modified. And in fact, so quantum mechanically what we have equals with some coefficient, and here we have f of dual, which is exactly trace in the fundamental representation, which is precisely what we evaluate 1/4 pi squared, something like that. But the important thing is that it comes in exactly the same way as this large gauge transformation, this winding configuration come in. And so if before we had a global symmetry associated with these axial rotations. So for example, we looked at the fermions, right? And so the axial current was taking this form, phi psi, right? For a Dirac fermion, so this was our so we were making an axial rotation. So the fact that there is no conservation, what happens is that if I have a theta angle will also, so if psi was going to minus I pi alpha psi, where alpha is is a rotation corresponding to axial transformations, then this symmetry is broken by quantum corrections, but it's broken by the term which couples to a theta angle. So it turns out that I can restore this axial rotation if I just rotate my fermions, it's no longer a symmetry. Right, because the current is not conserved anymore. However, it turns out that if I do this, and plus I shift by twice the angle, by twice that much, the theta angle, then it will be exactly the same thing. In other words, I can. This is a total derivative, right? So we wrote trace f mu as a del mu. So what you can think of is that I redefine what I mean by axial current by including a piece that comes from a theta angle. And so that new current will be conserved. So the result is that if you do all the algebra properly, that if you do axial rotation along with shifting your theta angle by 2 alpha, then everything is fine. Okay, so So this is symmetry. So this is axial symmetry. Axial symmetry unbroken by quantum corrections. Okay, so that's pretty much what I wanted to mention from the last time. So any questions?
Just a technical question. What did you mean by identify infinities on R3?
When I evaluate this boundary integral, it just depends on the value of phi fields at the bound.
Right.
Of course, it also depends on how I approach it on derivatives, but also the no derivative.
Right.
So identifying infinities, what I mean that it doesn't matter in which direction at infinity I go. My potentials approach the same value.
Okay.
So in this sense, the infinity is the same point, whether I go along the x direction or y direction.
Okay.
And actually, a precise construction of finding solutions of this type is even in my favorite generating. So you can look there. It's one of the last sections. It's actually quite simple and very straightforward generalization of Euclidean solutions. In fact, it's the way it's written is the same. All right, guys. So all what we did so far is gonna. It's the reason why we did this because we want to solve some mass H series, right? And so the idea is that supersymmetry usually helps us do it. It puts some constraint. We already learned that, for example, superpotential does not receive any quantum corrections. And some things that I mentioned is that in n equal 1 H series, there are only one loop correction. So it turns out that there is a theory in which we can solve exactly. And so what we'll try to do to do this, and this is a sort of called Cyber-Quickly model. So I will just start by giving the normal solution of that model, and then we'll try to discuss what if, because the solution of this model is based on a bunch of assumptions about what we expect to be a non-interpretive structure. Okay, so what is the model? So we start with n equal 1 supersymmetric Young-Mills. And so this model just have, and for concreteness, we're going to discuss SU2, right, vector multiply. So this is just n equal 1 vector multiply, and the coefficient of beta function here. As you remember, was 3 and c, so it was equal to 6. So this is n equal 1. Right? And so the theory, in this case, what happens is that the theory is positive. So the theory is asymptotically free, meaning that H coupling goes to zero as whatever the characteristic energy scale goes to infinity. Now, what this means, this also means that the theory will have a strong coupling scale. So there will be lambda. Coupling scale, and I'm going to denote this as lambda hat. Okay, so the reason why I put hat here because I want to distinguish it from a strong coupling scale of slightly modified mode. So as it is right now, this is just n equal 1 pure loop theory. So remember somewhere very early in the course, we talked about the Witten index, and that Witten index told us that how many supersymmetric vacuum we have, right? Or in other words, do we have a supersymmetric vacuum? This Witten index was counting the number. So Witten index. Witten index in the context that we discussed a very simple model of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and so Witten index was counting the number of bosonic ground states minus the number of fermionic ground states. And remember that the idea was that we can do this computation usually even classically, and once there are some quantum corrections, what will happen is that it is only possible for bosonic and fermionic state to be lifted together in order to form a massive supersymmetric multiple. And so what this told us is that whenever the Witten index is not zero, because it's defined as the difference, then there is a mismatch between bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom. And so for any non-zero Witten index, we guarantee to have supersymmetric ground states. So it turns out that it's possible to compute the Witten index in a pure blue theory, the one that I mentioned there. And so the Witten index, in this model turns out to be equal to 2. There are precisely two ground states, supersymmetric ground. Okay, so this is the fact that we need to know. And now we actually go to the Cyber-Quinton model. So the Cyber-Quinton model is n equal to supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. Okay. And so remember from the discussion last week, n equal to supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. This n equal 1 supersymmetric Young-Mills theory plus we have one chiral supercube in n joint representation. So you might think of this is that we have a gauge theory, right? So the n equal 1 supersymmetric multiple has a gauge potential, and then there is a wild fermion, a gauge 0. So those are also guys are in the edge of the representation. And then what we have, so you can think of that we have an adjoint complex Higgs field. Adjoint complex complex Higgs field plus the fermionic super particles. Okay, so that's model. Now, in the pure blue theory, we cannot write down any superpotential, so a classical superpotential vanishes. So one thing I want to introduce some notation. So this pi. So phi is in the adjoint representation. So this, and we talk about this C2H theory. So this is a three-dimensional complex field. So I can think of this as indices AB. Phi AB is 2 by 2 matrix. Okay, and so it's an adjoint representation. So under the element of the SU2, just transforms as appropriate for the adjoint transformation. So G is SU2. And as I said, phi is complex. That's a complex. So because we cannot write down any superpotential in this model, so we can just, you know, we have a construction, right? So this is the way how we would write down our supersymmetric n equal 1 supersymmetric gauge theory. And so in general, there are contribution to the scalar potential coming from F terms, from the superpotential, and coming from the D term, from kinetic terms, right? So kinetic term, so Keller potential here for the scalar Voltage is formed by bar V2 V5. And because I wrote my my scalar phi is a fundamental representation, I'm writing it by 2 by 2 matrix. Data space is a fundamental representation. So this is a classical Keller potential for the scalar. So if I compute the potential, it will just come from this, from the D-term. It comes from evaluating V2 theta bar of the Keller. And if we do that, with my notations of thinking about phi as 2 by 2 matrix, we will find out that I'm running ahead of myself. So the potential state is formed. So it's a trace of a commutator phi bar and phi, where we think about them as being as being 2 by 2 matrices. Okay, very good. So so what this tells us. This tells us that there is a moduli space, right? So there is a D term, there is a D term moduli space. Moduli space. And this moduli space is given by this condition. Now this moduli space, even though we have the equation for the moduli space classically, it must exist quantum mechanics because we can do our well, for school we know that super potential W does not receive quantum corrections. So if we started with a zero superpotential, we will get it zero. So whatever light directions we have, they will not be lifted. Now, so those are D-term equations, and I want to solve them in some way. But phi itself is not gauge invariant, right? So phi itself is not gauge invariant, and so I have a freedom of fixing the gauge. So let me explain you how we can think about the phi. So one thing that I didn't mention here is that phi is in the adjoint representation. So there is one constraint on these matrices, and that's the trace of phi must be equal to zero. So what I can do, I can decompose any 2 by 2 matrix into three components, right? So you can think, I can do this, where phi 1, phi 2, and phi 3 just complex scalar fields, right? Okay. If you look at this D-term equation, so the solution to this D-term equation is that phi must be along the diagonal, right? So phi must be proportional to the phi three of 1, 0, 0, minus 1 in order to satisfy D-term. So I can write down phi. So if you look at some of the papers, for example, in the original paper by Seifert and Witten, so you can think of that we can parameterize the classical moduli space in this way, where A is an arbitrary complex number. But there is another way to parameterize this moduli space. So we can think of the moduli space as a space, a complex A-plane, But this is not the gauge invariant. This is not the gauge invariant definition. So I have to choose a particular gauge. I have to decompose my two-by-two matrix in a particular way and parameterize the modular space in this manner. There is a gauge invariant coordinate I can introduce on the modular space. And so this gauge invariant coordinate is something that we will play with. So I have phi, it's two-by-two matrix, and it transforms. Remember, I told you that it transforms in this manner. So in order for me to introduce something gauge invariant, I have to take traces. But trace phi vanishes. So the simplest coordinate that I might introduce is going to be equal to trace phi squared. Right? So this one will not vanish. And it's obviously gauge invariant, right? So the thing is that what we're going to do, well, first of all, I can go from this gauge invariant A coordinate and gauge invariant U. So you can see the relation. So this is going to be just trace A squared 0, 0, A squared. And so what we have that U equals, in my initialization, to a squared. So you can ask, why did I choose U? There are infinitely many other gauge invariant combinations. In particular, I could have taken a trace of phi to the n, where n is an arbitrary integer. And this will be, and use this as a gauge invariant combination. Well, what you can do, you can show, and so one way to do this is just to use this decomposition to show that trace phi to the n is just a polynomial of trace phi squared. Okay, so locally away maybe from some complications, U is a well-defined coordinate, and strictly speaking, well, I could have used any other one, but I choose to use U. Okay, so if we have U as our coordinate on the modular space, why don't we discuss what will happen on this modular space? The power potential, right? So my U is a quadratic in phi. So on the modular space, the power potential takes the form of this type. So it's a square root of U bar U. And this is a model that we discussed before when we studied symmetry breaking. And so in this case, there is an orbifold singularity. We have a Calic potential of this type, and we evaluate the metric of the modular space. So there will be an orbifold singularity at the origin from this modular space. And so let's try. Yes, I tried to avoid it, but I cannot. So let's try to figure out what the singularity is associated with. And so what I want to do is to see what will happen as we go with this modular space. Right? So,
what we want to do is, what is the physics? U is not equal to C. Right? So we have our field phi, which is in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. And so what will happen if U is not equal to zero, if U is not equal to zero. So what that corresponds, my gauge group SU2 must be broken, okay? So we can ask exactly what is the pattern of the breaking of this gauge group. Well, so the D-term equation tells us that we have to put two of the generators of the SU2 algebra to zero. So two of the generators will be broken, right? And so two of the gauge bosons will get mass, and one will, corresponding to a generator 1 minus 1, will remain unbroken. So the SU2 on the modulus case will be broken to a U1. And we can actually see that that leads to a correct counting of the degrees of freedom. So if we have this superheat mechanism, we have here one vector superheat, right? And then we have one massless chiral multiplet corresponding to U, one massless U field. Due to this Higgsing, two gauge bosons get mass, and we lost 2 degrees of freedom, and those are the 2 degrees of freedom that will come from the phi one and phi two components of the adjoint chiral superheat. Two gauge bosons will get that. So once I see, if we do the computation and we ask the question exactly what will be the mass of this W boson once I go away from the origin, then those gauge bosons will get a mass which is proportional to the gauge topic times a VAB of my field. So in this case, the VAB is just equal to A. So in the standard Higgs mechanism, that VAB was fixed because you had a potential for the Higgs field. So in this case, A is unconstrained; it can be anything. But this is exactly the same formula how the masses of W's occur in the ordinary Higgs mechanism. And so we can do analysis. We can do analysis in this model as well and find that the masses of W would be given by this expression. So now what this tells us is that if I go back to the origin. To the origin of the moduli space, so I will have two gauge bosons, and those gauge bosons will have charges +/-1, and precisely at the origin of the moduli space, they will become masses. So you can think of that that the existence of the orbifold singularity of the classical moduli space is an indication that we're missing some fields in our low energy effect fraction, right? And those fields are these two massive gauge bosons, which will become massless. So the theory has a bunch of symmetries, right? And so one of those symmetries is the axial symmetry. So the symmetry model, the model has one axial symmetry, and under this axial symmetry, what happens is that our field U changes into the minus I alpha U as charge plus one. And this symmetry is actually anomalous. And so in order to, I can compensate an anomaly by shifting a theta angle. And so the theta angle is shifted. So what we would like to do now is to try to write down effective field theory on the moduli space. Okay. So on the moduli space, right? So we know that what will generically happen is that the SU2 H group is broken to a U1. So we have a U1 vector superfield, right? And then we have plus one massless. One massless U chiral superfield. Okay. So now, if I'm going to write down what's the effective Lagrangian on the moduli space, just restricting to a massless superfield, so there will be a Keller term, right? So U to theta, R, and there will be a Keller potential for U U R. So first of all, this U field, this chiral superfield, is going to be uncharged under the U1 gauge group. And the reason why there is a reason you can just do a complicated, it's not complicated, you just do the superheat mechanism and you find out that it doesn't carry charge under the remaining U1. But there is a very quick route to see that that's indeed the case. So what happens is that when we have this super, so what we do, we have SUSY Higgs mechanism. In n equal 2 supersymmetric gauge theory. And the Higgs mechanism doesn't break this extended supersymmetry. So in particular, what this means, so if we say that as far as the gauge sector concerns, the SU2 is broken down to a U1. So what we have to have, in order to have an unbroken n equal to supersymmetry, we must have n equal to vector superfield, and that equals to n equal 1, n equal 1 vector superfield. And then I have a plus 1 chiral superfield in adjoint representation, right? But adjoint for a U1 means that it is uncharged, right? So for a U1, this means neutral. Okay. So there will be some unknown Keller potential. It will receive some Keller, it will receive some correction. So I don't know what it is. I'm just going to write it down as a Keller potential. And then on top of that, there will be a superpotential. And we know that there is no superpotential that contains just the scalar, because that part of the superpotential is protected against quantum corrections equals zero to begin with. But then there is a term corresponding to n equal one vector superfield. So that's an integral over half of the superspace. And the U1 coupling, so this is the U1 gauge coupling. And so here I have a trace of W alpha squared plus remission conjugate. And so tau is theta over 2 pi plus 4 pi I over g squared, right? So g is a U1 coupling. So except that here we have to allow that our U1 coupling will change as we go on the moduli space, right? So our U1 coupling will be a function of U. It cannot depend on the U bar, because this is a superpotential and U is a chiral superfield. So it can depend only on the chiral superfield, but it also can depend on something else. So we're asking the question, what is the most general effect of this theory we can give? And so what else it can depend on? So this tau, when you read some reviews on cyberquantum papers for the original paper, so there is some confusion. So there are two couplets. So there is microscopic tau for the SV2 coupling. SV2 coupling. And I'm going to call that tau SV2. Okay? And then there is a tau. So a tau is a gauge coupling of a U1 field, on the modular space. So in principle, they are not the same. So the SV2 coupling is not equal to coupling star, which is coupling of the U1 on the modular space. But so we keep discussing this, and the question is, I put a comma here, so which implies that it must depend on something else. And that something else must be something that should be sensitive. It should know what gauge coupling we started with. Well, as we know that the theory in general, non-abelian gauge theories are not conformal, and so there will be a running of the gauge coupling. So we did a computation yesterday to evaluate the one-loop coefficient of the beta. And so what we found is that the series that we are talking is n equal 2. So the one-loop beta function is equal to 2nc, right? And we don't have any fundamental matter. So that's all what it will be. So in our case, it's equal to 4. And so it's a positive number. So the model that we're discussing right now is asymptotically free. And so so there will be a strong coupling scale. And I'm going to call this strong coupling scale lambda. Right? So it is a different strong coupling scale compared to the strong coupling scale I was mentioning before. Okay. Good. So this coupling tau, right? So it's this strong coupling scale lambda, it's related to the SU2 gauge coupling, and in particular there is a one loop running, right? So it's given by this expression, pi square over ln lambda over mu. So if you're gonna tell me what is the value of the SU2 coupling, which is gonna be node G not zero, at some scale mu naught, then I will tell you what the strong coupling scale of my theory is. And so when I ask the question, what my low energy effective action can depend on, so it can depend where on the modular space I am, and it must be sensitive to this characteristic of the microscopic field, it must be sensitive to the strong coupling scale, to the SV2 strong coupling scale. Okay, so any questions so far? So think, is there anything we could have missed on the modular space? So again, the argument is that the whole modular space is defined by the expectation value of the scalar field. And if that scalar field develops a web, it will break the gauge symmetry. There will be a Higgs mechanism. The gauge symmetry will be broken to a U1. Okay, so there will be a U1 field, and just counting or simply saying that the supersymmetry will not be broken, along with a vector superfield, there will be one massless chiral superfield. And so this is the most general effective action, or energy effective action we can write down, that includes a vector superfield and a massless chiral superfield, which is here. Okay. So there is nothing else we can write down. So in this theory, so finally, let me mention one more thing, which would be important for us. So in this theory, there will be instant interactions. There will be instant interactions. And so what we would like to do, we would like to know how big those instant interactions will be. Well, so the instant interactions are the set of points of the Euclidean action. And so the lowest, except for a trivial one, the smallest contribution will come from the one instant transactor. So this is one instant correction. And so this one instant correction we evaluated explicitly, and it's given by e to the minus a pi squared over only g squared. And here I have to use, I actually have to use. This is an SU2 couple, right? So you talk about instant in the non-abelian theory. So now what I can do, I can actually substitute M1 loop running for the SU2 gauge couple. So I can write this down as minus e to the minus minus and minus gives me plus, so it will be plus E naught ln lambda divided by mu, right? So, and in our case, E naught equals 4, so the instant interaction will have strengths of this type. So it will be lambda divided by mu raised to 4th power. Very good. And so one thing to forget. So tau is a function of u, right? So in particular, this means that the theta, most of the theta angle and the u1 gauge coupling will depend on the marginal space. So if we understood that this is the most general effective action that we can do, that we can have given the particle content. So in order to solve a solution, we solve the theory, solve the theory. So this is equivalent to find tau as a function of u and lambda. So if you know everywhere, if we know everywhere what this U1 coupling is, then we know everything about the theory, and presumably putting in the regime corresponding to a strong couple.
Did we assume that the instant correction is very small in the couple?
First of all, as you can see, that the strength of the instant interaction is determined by sort of intrinsic property of the theory, which is a strong coupling scale, so it's a fixed number. And then in a way how I written it actually depends on an arbitrary scale.
Yes.
So the point is that what is this scale? What is the appropriate scale to talk about? As we move on a modular space, the appropriate scale is mu. So in the modular space, all these instant correction must come as holomorphic quantities. And the appropriate scale to talk is actually an absolute value of the u, right? So because that's a place at which we are using the u, and that's a natural scale. That's a natural scale at which we expect our effective theory to take down. So what we will have, that I will write down in a little bit what do we expect for this function, right? But the instanton contribution will be something of this type. Lambda to the fourth of the U squared. Okay, so that would be a strand. So that would be one instanton contribution. I have to say a four there. So that's a natural. That's the natural size of the correction due to instantons. We expect for example, for this coupling on the moduli space. And so you can see that in particular, the instanton contributions will get very strong here. Okay. So, very strong. So the question whether I am at recoupling or not, it's not a question relevant to the SU2. It's a question relevant exactly where I am on the modular space. Yeah. So for example, if I am on the modular space for very large values of U, so there will be a region here, right? So the region, say, with a characteristic size of the strong coupling scale of the SU2.
Yes.
So if I am way further away from that central region, mm-hmm. right? So remember, at that central point, there was an orbifold singularity, right? So now I'm actually going to talk about my modular space in terms of this H invariant coordinate. So if I am far away from there, then my instanton corrections are small, and so I can talk in terms of the weak coupling. So I guess what you are saying. So if I can say this now. So if U, absolute value of U is much larger, much larger than lambda squared, we expect a weak coupling. For tau, right? So tau is 4 pi over G squared plus A. So, but I'll be more precise now. I'll explain exactly what I mean by this. Okay. So, and please ask me this question again, just maybe in 3 minutes. So let's see exactly what is happening. So are you guys done with a spontaneous symmetry breaking course? More or less,
no. It goes on until the 20th.
Did he talk about the Higgs mechanism in gauge series?
Not yet.
So suppose I have a question for you. Suppose I have just an ordinary Higgs mechanism. So this is just a Higgs mechanism. Higgs mechanism in quantum field theory. Right? So I have an ordinary quantum field theory, and I have a Higgs mechanism in which SU2 is rolled into a U1. Right. So here I start with the Young-Mills coupling, and then I go to a U1 coupling. What's the relation between those two couplings? If you do if you start a Higgs mechanism classic, what's the relation between them? They're the same. I mean, that's the most trivial example, that's the simplest answer that you can come up. But you can actually write down and, so in some sense, if you haven't seen this before, what you have here, you have a Lagrangian of this type, 1 over 4 G and N squared, FVUA, And then some of the gauge bosons here get mass. And so the only one that is massless is a U1. And so so the one that at the classical level, the massless one, will have an effective action, which will come from obviously from this effective action. And it will have a term 1 over 4, 4g squared f mu. F mu, where F mu is the field strength of the unbroken U1 due to this Higgs mechanism. So classically, what I want to say is that classically, if you have a Higgs mechanism, what will happen is that the coupling of so let me say first classically. So classically, this is an exact statement. The non-abelian gauge coupling is equal to the gauge coupling of the group that's left unbroken. But now we can make this statement. We can make this statement also including quantum correction. Right. So we know that what will happen is there is. So this is classic. And classically, that would be a perfect. You know, this is a statement valid at all energy scales. So what we know is that quantum mechanically couplings will depend on energy, and so they will change. And also what we know is that, in particular, the running of gauge coupling in abelian and non-abelian theories is different. So quantum mechanically, this statement still makes sense, right? Only if I tell you that those two couplings I equate the couplings at the energy scale at which I have my spontaneous symmetry thing. So this equality is at energy scale of spontaneous symmetry thing. Let's just try to understand what this means quantum mechanically. Okay. So in our context. So we start with the SU2 gauge theory. This is 1 over 1. I'm just going to write down g squared. G and mu squared. And then here there is a scale, right? So in our case, the Higgs mechanism is provided by the expectation value of the scalar, right? So in our case, the appropriate scale at which the spontaneous symmetry breaking occurs is u to the 1/2, the absolute value of u to the 1/2. But so we know that this theory is actually asymptotically free. So we know that 1 over g young mu squared is going to be equal to minus 4 over 8 pi squared log from coupling scale over mu, right? So that's just a one loop running of our SU2 gauge coupling. And so in particular, what this tells me that with respect to this mu, there will be a value of mu precisely corresponding to lambda, at which my gauge coupling will blow up. Right. So we'll go to infinity. So this is a picture, this is a renormalization group running of the SU2 gauge coupling. Now, suppose I am asking the question, so I told you that the relevant scale, once we see it on the modular space, is the scale corresponding to the web. So suppose I choose my scale. Well, first of all, if I want to study Syriac recoupling or semi-classically, I cannot choose that lower than left. Okay, that's the first indication that something funny must go at the middle of the modular space. Okay, but I can ask the question, what will happen if this U is very large? So in particular, this is returning back to your question. So we are in a regime when absolute value of U is much larger than lambda squared. So I'm somewhere sitting here. Okay, so I choose, I went on the modular space far away from the origin. And so at this point, what I'm doing Higgs in my theory, right? So we have a Higgs magnet at this scale. And so once there is a Higgs mechanism, then precisely at this scale, the U1 coupling will be equal to the Young-Mills coupling. So this is a value. This is going to be equal the value square of the U1 coupling. So the Higgs mechanism occurred at that scale, and so this is going to be the value for U1. Now, what do you think will happen? So now, if I am in a context of low energy effective action, what do you think will happen with this U1 cup? I don't ask the question about the SU2, if the effective action doesn't make sense to ask, because SU2 contains massive gauge bosons, it's already Higgs. So what will happen with this cup, with the U1 cup? You want to say that it will go to zero.
Yeah.
That would have happened if we would have had charged particles. But if you're saying on the modular space, there are no charged magnetic fields under this U1, right? The only field that we have is this chiral field U. But that chiral field U, I kept emphasizing, is U. Because there are no charged matter, the U1 coupling gets unchanged. So if I ask the question, if I'm going to measure my coupling, how should I think about renormalization group running? Well, at scales much larger than U, I have the full SU2 gauge theory, so I have the SU2 running, but after that, the coupling stopped running, and it's just a constant number. If I go now to a different point on the modular space, closer to the origin, right, then I will get a different value of U, right? So this is, for example, U1, and this is U2. So U2 is less than U1. So what will happen is that, so this one is G1, G2 squared. So my U1 coupling grows. So the closer I come to the, again, the picture is, so this was our moduli space, complex U. So there is an origin here. There is a characteristic scale associated with a strong coupling of the SU2, lambda squared. So the closer I come to this region, what will happen is that my coupling will grow stronger and stronger. In fact, I can write down exactly what is if I just do perturbative computations. If I do one loop analysis, then I know exactly how this thing changes. Right. So let me write it down. So the whole point is that tau of U is going to be equal to tau of SU2. Right? If we do this matching. So what I did now, I extended from the gauge coupling to a complexified gauge coupling, including this data angle. But it's clear that the analysis will go through. I cannot write down the equality sign, but I can write down an approximate equality sign. The reason why I'm writing an approximate equality sign, because this is true only, for example, in perturbative. So true only perturbative. Now I know how my SU2 coupling runs, and so I know what tau of u is, and so that's just the one loop running. And so tau of u is 1 over 2 pi I ln lambda to the fourth over u squared. But this is just the one loop running extended to a complexified coupling, just simply coming from this this equality. Okay? So this is just a one loop result. And so that's, again, we have to be careful. That's a one loop result in this microscopic model theory. Okay? And it's a perturbative statement. And so strictly speaking, the way how it's written, I should put an approximate sign, because the beta functions that I use here in order to compute the running is the SU2 beta function. But I put the full equality sign. Because what I can do now, I can say, well, I know it must be a holomorphic function, right? And so it must depend holomorphically on u and lambda, right? So it depends holomorphically on u and lambda. And but then there can be, so what class can it be? Because the only non-superlative effects that we are aware of are the instanton effects. Okay? And one instanton effect, right, so we estimated it before, it's lambda to the fourth over u squared, right? So that's a one instanton effect. But that one instanton effect corresponded to a simplest winding map when the winding number was equal to 1. So if I have a winding number corresponding to k, then the instanton action will have an additional factor of k. And so in a k instanton contribution will be lambda to the fourth over u squared raised to the kth power. And so what I have actually, I have a sum. So from k equal 1 to infinity of the instanton contributions coming with coefficients, C sub n. So the claim is that this is the most general, this is the most general expression for the effective coupling, which is allowed by holomorphicity. Which is allowed by holomorphicity, includes perturbatively correct and another thing is holomorphicity is perturbatively correct, and then there is another implicit assumption here. And that implicit assumption, which if I have time, I will explain that the whole hell breaks loose if we remove this assumption, was an assumption about what possible non-perturbative corrections are. So in particular, the reason why we wrote it in this way, because we assume that there are only integer instanton contributions, right? So there are contributions which have action, right? Contributions passing, again, you have to understand that what we are writing down is supposed to be exact, including all quantum correction, right? So these contributions pass integral, coming from the instanton actions into the minus instanton with the winding number k. So you can show that if your instanton action has a winding number k, then the action of that k instanton, so e to the minus s instanton with a winding number k, is the same as k times the one instanton action, right? So in lambda to the fourth over u squared is a one instanton contribution. And so I'm writing down a series of the powers u to the pk. Okay, so the last assumption is integer instanton contributions are the only non-perturbative effects.
How is this function holomorphic in U and lambda? You have a power series in 1 over U squared.
So what I have to say, it is a holomorphic. When we talk about function being holomorphic, it's holomorphic about which point,
right?
So what you're saying is very valid, because it's rephrasing it, when do I trust this expansion? Right. In order for me to trust this expansion, I have to go outside that dual circle. So in other words, that's a holomorphic expansion around u equal infinity. So when u is very large, then I have an expansion of this type.
But then the logarithm becomes bad, because then you...
Yes, the log. No. The log goes to infinity, but that's what you expect. This is actually related to your question before. So as you go to infinity, log gets very large.
Mm-hmm.
That means that tau gets very large. But tau is one of the coupling. So the gauge coupling gets very small.
But what I mean is that if you expand this thing around u equals infinity, then you're expanding the log around zero. It doesn't have a...
I don't expand log around zero.
Log is not a holomorphic function around zero. If you take u to infinity,
right,
then lambda
for u squared goes to zero. Like holomorphic function, so let's see. How about if I say analytic function? I learned the complex analysis using Russian textbooks. So what you mean holomorphic is expanded in a Taylor series expansion. So you're right. There will be monodrops. If that's what you're referring to. Okay, so you don't know what you are. So I'll explain. So these contributions. Okay, so let me go back and try to explain it still the way how I would think. Forget about this.
Right.
So then this is just a one loop result,
mm-hmm.
And this one loop result is valid only when u is much larger than that.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Much larger, but still finite.
Very large, but still fine. Okay, because in that case, my SU2 coupling is weak, and I can think about Higgs phenomena being classical. And that's what the classical Higgs phenomena would be. Now, by saying that it's holomorphic, what I mean is that the coupling, or in that effective action, U is a chiral superhero. So by saying that it's holomorphic, what I mean is that W over W bar equals to zero. It doesn't depend on the U bar. That's all I mean. It might have singularities, and it might have, in particular, it might have branch points. It might have all singularities branch points, or as in this case, it might have a log is a branch point of an infinite order. Okay, and that would be crucial for us to, because the solution to a cyber-critic model will be an explicit prediction for the values of these coefficients. Now, what I'm saying is that Cn is an arbitrary set of, I mean, in this case, it's just a set of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to solve this theory, and we're going to determine each of these numbers exactly. Okay. So now the question is, now what I was telling you holomorphic about infinity, I can explain. You guys have a lecture today, right?
Not until when?
You have to leave it. Okay, so I will see, as long as there are 70% people left, I will continue talking until we are kicked out. Because I want you to understand this. This is, because if you read the original literature, it might be a little bit more difficult. And so please ask me questions that will help. So let's look f of z. So I would call f of z as a holomorphic function. It doesn't depend on the z bar. But there are two ways how I can write down an expansion of this holomorphic function. So near zero, near z equals to zero, f of z equals sum, n equals zero to infinity, z to cn. But I can do what I would still call a holomorphic expansion around z equals infinity. So I can do it formally by saying that I take a complex plane and I compactify. And then come back to, I guess, the question you asked, what do I mean the same at infinity? That's exactly compactification of the plane to a sphere. So in this case, how can I do? I'm just going to write down f of z is minus 1 over z, 1 minus 1 over z. And then I'm going to write it down minus 1 over z, sum 1 over z, which is a k power sum over k. So I will get a different expansion. I would still call that's a holomorphic expansion, except about a different point. So from this perspective, except for this log, what we have a holomorphic expansion. And the only thing that you correctly pointed out, there is, strictly speaking, it's not holomorphic, given the logs. Okay, so very good. Now coming back to some things that we discussed with you and last time, most people left, so I'm just going to mention very briefly. When we wrote down the explicit instanton solution yesterday, there was a free parameter, and that free parameter was the size of the instanton. And you were asking me what will happen. Because instantons are characterized by an arbitrary parameter, and we have to integrate over all those parameters. Right? And the integral over that parameter will be divergent in normal field series. And the divergence will be the infrared divergence from the instanton. The divergence will come from the small instanton. The small instanton divergence. So in this case, you can think of it that there is a cutoff. The cutoff is provided by you. The cutoff is provided by you. So the integral of the instanton size is being cut out by you. So in the supersymmetric field series, those CMs are just numbers. So let me say it again for all of you. So when we define instantons very carefully, instanton might have zero modes, okay? And we have to be very careful about integrating when we talk about instanton contributions. I was very cavalier here, so I wrote the action in this way, but then I have to multiply by the instanton by the action. Well, significantly, it would be divergent if my instanton would have a zero mode, right? An infinite degeneracy. And so the point is that in ordinary non-abelian gauge series, there is indeed the divergence of this type. However, in the model that we talk about, such divergence does not exist because our instantons have a natural infrared cutoff, and that infrared cutoff is provided by the web on the modular space. All right, guys. So we are all happy, huh? So let's continue. Puzzles. I think it will be maybe a good for some of you who believe in. So let me explain you why. So people knew this before supercomputing solution, but they also knew that is not well defined. Okay, the answer is incorrect. So on one hand, there is nothing else it appears that we can do. On the other hand, it is clear that something is missing. Okay. So I'm going to explain you why, what are the puzzles of this solution, and so the cyber-critical solution of the model was a way of trying to resolve those puzzles, and they were successful in doing it. So puzzles. So there are two puzzles. So puzzle number one. So we look at this tau of u, and I told you, and we have quite an extended discussion, that this tau of u is a holomorphic function. Is a holomorphic function of u. But then, if you open your textbook on complex analysis, I have my favorite Russian. So what happens is that if you do that, then the real part of tau and the imaginary part of tau, if tau is a holomorphic function, are actually harmonic functions. So then those guys are what's known as harmonic functions. But if they are harmonic functions, then there is a statement that if you have a function which is harmonic everywhere in space, a function harmonic in an unbounded region. Is bounded, it is the other way around. A harmonic function in the bounded region has its minimum and maximum value. Okay, so if I have a function which is harmonic, a function which is harmonic in the unbounded region cannot achieve its minimum or maximum. It's unbounded function. Is an unbounded function, and it's not bounded from above and it's not bounded from below. But so in particular, this means that the imaginary part of tau is unbounded from below. That imaginary part of tau is equal to 4 pi over g squared, where g is a U1 low energy effective coupling. And if it's unbounded from below, it means that somewhere, it must be negative. It must become negative, which means that the square of the coupling will become negative. Now, if the square of the coupling gets negative, then the theory is not unitary anymore. So the first contradiction with the supersymmetry and the assumption that what we have is complete is we led to a contradiction that our low energy effective action must break unitarity. You can actually be very explicit and see where exactly this happens. So what you can do, you can forget about all these instant interactions and just use the one loop result and go towards the origin of the modular space. And you will see that as you come closer to the origin of the modular space, it's actually clear from this picture, right? So the log will change sign, depending whether u is larger than lambda or less than that. And that will lead to breaking of the unitarity or breaking of the g square of the low energy u1. That's one side, one puzzle. And I'm explaining the second puzzle and we'll go. We'll break for today. I don't want to. Because we do that, you are from what? Can I ask you to fill in the evaluation form?
Oh,
because people make giving me hard fun.
Oh, sorry.
So, guys, again, please fill the evaluation form and bring it today to the end.
Okay.
So, let's see. So, the second part. So the second puzzle is related to something that I started earlier today, and that's the idea of the Witten index. Okay. So we started with a theory
we started with the theory that they didn't have any superpotential. And so now I'm going to deform the theory. So deform the theory. And I'm going to deform the theory by introducing a tree-level superpotential. So I'm just giving a mass. I'm just giving a mass Q to my chiral super Q. And so in doing so, I told you that the n equal 2 does not allow any superpotential. So once I have this superpotential, whenever m is not equal to 0, what I have is that n equal 2 is going to be broken to n equal 1, right? So in that case, I have n equal 1 supersymmetry. So it will still be a supersymmetric, but it will not be n equal 2 supersymmetric moment. So is there a regime? So if that is the case, so this is a massive field. So what we can do, we can integrate phi out, right? So we can integrate this field out. It's a massive field. So we should not include it in slow energy effective action. And so at low energies, we get a U1 vector super key. Okay, and according to Witten index, it must confine. There must be two vacua left. Okay, and in particular, so it must confine, and there must be a mass gap, all lots of nice things. But the problem is that in our low energy effective actions, there are simply no charged fields. There is nothing that can remove that U1. So it looks like that everywhere in the moduli space we have a U1. So the problem is that on our moduli space, on the moduli space, there are no states that can Higgs a U1, right? So that U1 must not be there anymore. We must have a mass gap in this theory. And having a mass gap in the theory means that we must give a mass to that photon. That remaining a photon. But we cannot Higgs at U1 because in order to Higgs the gauge theory, we must have fields charged under the gauge theory. So it turns out that what Seiberg and Witten understood, they understood exactly what are the states that are missing. And those are the monopole states that we're studying monopoles next time. And so it turns out that if you include monopoles and diodes in your spectrum, what you will find out is that you will get precisely the state that you need to Higgs the model on the moduli space, and moreover, you will restore it to the unitarity. So including monopoles and diodes, you solve two puzzles. But in the remaining 3 minutes, what I want to do, I'm going to ask the question, okay, so you are telling me about integrating out, and at low energies, we will get n equal 1, get nil series. When such thing, how can I trust? When can we trust? So what I want to do in the last 2 minutes is explain you the idea of integrating out, and it's actually very simple. And so basically what I want to do, I want to establish a relation between the strong coupling scale in the n equal 2. This is n equal 2 strong coupling scale, and this is n equal 1 strong coupling scale. And we'll try to understand exactly when this integration out makes sense. So much like when we do the Higgs mechanism, once we integrate out the field, at that scale, the couplings are the same. So tau n equal 2, evaluated at the scale m, must be equal to tau of n equal 1, evaluated at scale m. And so the only way when this is consistent,
So okay to you if imaginary part of tau n equal two is much less than one. So if it's much less than one, then the gauge coupling is small, and so we have a phenomenon of integrating out massive states, which is weakly coupled. But let's try to understand the relation once we do that. So this guy, tau of n equal two, is equal to, well, so I can 1 over the square of the n equal 2 coupling, right? So it's going to be equal to minus 4 over a pi square log lambda over m, right? So that's the value of the n equal 2 coupling, including the running corresponding to n equal 2 at the scale m. And it must be equal 1 over g n equal 1 squared. Now, the n equal 1 coupling runs in a different way, right? Remember, this number here was a coefficient g naught, which was 2nc minus nf, the number of flavors, and that gave us 4. In the n equal 1 case, this coefficient here is 3nc minus nf. So the coefficient here is going to be minus 6 over 8 pi squared log lambda hat over n. So what I'm trying to emphasize in this simple exercise, okay, so now if you do this, if you solve this arithmetic equation, what you will find out that lambda over m to the fourth power is the same as lambda hat over m to the sixth power. So we are finding that lambda hat to the sixth, lambda to the fourth, and m squared. So the point of this exercise to show is that when we integrate out states in gauge series, the couplings are the same, right, at the scale we do the integration out. But the strong coupling scale are different. So we still get a monodular gauge series. That theory will be fine, but it has a different coupling. It has a different strong coupling scale. All right, guys, so as I told you, next time what we're going to do, we're going to resolve these puzzles after we study the monopoles. So we'll discuss the general monopoles and Cook Poiliquin monopole, and then we'll solve the monopole. And you don't have anything.